Hi, I'm Lori Feathers, a bookstore owner and writer in Dallas, Texas.
And I'm Sam Jordison, a publisher from Norwich in the UK. And this is Across the Pond,
a podcast for readers of fiction eager to discover the most discussed and anticipated books on both sides of the Atlantic.
All right, let's dive in.
Hello, Sam.
Hey, Lori, how are you doing?
I'm good, and I'm amused because you put me on to this really great Washington Post article by Ron Charles that ran on February 8th. It's entitled, What Readers Hate Most in Books, From Dreams to Italics. Tell us a little bit about this article. It's a lot of fun.
Yes, it is great. So Ron Charles, who is the fantastic critic and all-round good guy at the Washington Post, writes a lot about books and the world of books, and has a great newsletter, which, let me preface this conversation by recommending that to our listeners, because it's a really good newsletter. It's really fun, full of good tips about good things to read as well. Anyway, he asked readers of that newsletter to write in and describe the things that most annoy them in books. And says in response he got a, quote, tsunami of bile. So there have been quite a few pet peeves that readers have been storing up.
People had views.
Yeah, people have views, yeah. They do not like dream sequences, for instance, which I think, on the whole, you know, give or take Finnegan's Wake, it's very rare that a dream sequence in any format, book, film, TV program, whatever, is convincing.
So that would be one of your pet peeves as well?
I think so. I mean, the thing about all these pet peeves is they're only bad if they don't work. And writing really is the art of getting away with things. So, you know, there will always be writers who can do these things and do them well. But having said that, there are quite a few other things on this list that I found myself nodding along with.
So okay.
The use of italics, for instance. And nine times out of 10 sequences in italics in books just say to me, skip this bit. It's the bit where the writer's trying too hard, pushing too hard. And there is something about those sloping letters that makes me just want to leap over it.
Okay.
Another one that has annoyed his readers is the current fashion of writers not using speech marks around dialogue.
Oh, quotation marks.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's with that?
I don't know, is the honest answer. Lots of writers do this or don't do this, maybe I should say. And I remember years ago reading an interview with the great E.L. Doctorow, you know, the author of Ragtime and
yes.
Waterworks. And he was one of the first writers I noticed who didn't use speech marks. I mean, obviously, James Joyce doesn't, but he has a different way of doing it and blah, blah, blah. But Doctorow, and he had this whole thing that he just hated them. They look like terrible squiggles on the page, he said, and they're clutter. And I never quite understood it. I mean, it's fine if you're a writer as good as Doctorow and you can get away with it. And a reader almost instinctively knows who is speaking when. But when you're not, and let's face it, not many writers are as good as Doctorow. it can become really confusing, especially when there's more than one person speaking in the same paragraph, which I've noticed happening more and more, where you just having to keep retrace to try and work out who's speaking, or even indeed to work out if someone is speaking at all.
Or just thinking the thought.
Yeah, right. And I don't know. Do you have an opinion on this? What's wrong with quotation marks?
I have to say that I don't feel strongly about it unless it's not working and I'm having to work too hard to figure it out.
Right.
Which does happen occasionally. But are you seeing more and more submissions that you get, Sam, that folks are just deciding not to use quotation marks?
Yeah, I think so. And more published books as well. And I think possibly this is one of the things that irritates me about it. And I don't know if this is a good thing to be irritated by or not, because it's a fashion. I always worry about fashions in writing because you've got to have a reason to do something. And that reason shouldn't be just blindly following everyone else. There's got to be, you know, you've got to think through what you're doing with your craft and why you're doing it. If writers are just blindly following, it's often a bad sign that their book is not their own to some degree, and they haven't properly considered all the possibilities. I mean, the other big bugbear of mine in this regard is the overuse of the present tense and books that should be written in the past tense that have been written in the present tense just because there is a current theory that it adds a sense of immediacy, when really I don't think it does very often, unless the writer is very attuned to what they're doing and why.
Yeah. Well, there's a whole list of other ones here. This one I found very amusing. One of the respondents was complaining, her name is Christy Hart, that she found a factual inaccuracy in a book, and that when boiling maple sap to make maple syrup, you don't actually stir the sap. you just let it boil. So that was a kind of esoteric factual inaccuracy, but they also list some others. But I think that we've all come across a book that has something that maybe we know a little bit about for some reason, and we're like, no, that's not really how it works, or that's not really how it happens.
Yeah, that's right. And it's really funny in the article, the way he presents it. But there are quite serious things about the craft of writing here, I guess. And anything that makes you lose faith in the author as an authority is a problem. So you've got to get these things right.
And I guess another big category was typos and grammatical errors, which goes to what you're saying about, you know, kind of having faith in the storyteller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and having faith in the publisher as well. I mean, typos and grammatical errors are the stuff of nightmares. But every book has them.
Yeah, but some have them in more frequency and more glaring examples, I think, than others. Here's one that's I'm a little bit sensitive about. Excessive length, especially as a misimpression of prestige. Now, maybe the listeners of this podcast know I'm a lover of the big, big books. So I kind of like length, maybe not so much if it's excessive. What do you think about this one?
I think the key word here is excessive. And if the book can justify being that long, it's completely fine. If it can't, it's a problem. So, you know, as the publisher of Duck's New Report,
right?
I wouldn't cut a word out of that because it's just what it is, and it's perfect. It's wonderful. But, you know, some books, they can drag on, you know, but you can have a 150-page book that is too long.
Yes, true. And if you're just trying to, I don't know that it would seem like not a good commercial decision on the part of a publisher to just, you know, publish a book with a lot of fat in it just to, I don't know, make it seem like more important.
I don't know if anyone's that cynical, but yeah, I mean, they cost more to print the big books as well.
Yes, exactly. So what do you think about this one? Confusing timelines was an irritant.
Yes. I mean, yes, again, if it's confusing and needlessly confusing, I can imagine that being irritating. But then sometimes as a reader, you should be confused and not quite know what's going on. So there is that.
Yeah, there's something to be said about just like a linear chronology. But I've also read some really well-written books that kind of do a reverse chronology, which I think is if it's well done, it's very effective. And I'm always impressed when people do that with finesse, because I think it would be awfully confusing to keep kind of straight in your mind about who could have possibly known what at what period of time.
I think here, my general feeling is keep it straightforward unless you've got a really good reason not to.
Here's a pet peeve of mine that someone else also hates. Unrealistically clever kids and talking animals. I hate both of these.
Well, some kids are clever, I don't know. Talking animals. Well, just before we started speaking, I've been working on the edits of a wonderful book that we're publishing in the autumn by Adam Biles, which is a sequel to Animal Farm.
And so we naturally have talking animals, right?
We naturally have talking animals, yeah. So at the moment, I'm not hearing anything against talking animals because they're great.
Are they unrealistically clever, though?
They are realistically stupid, I would say, most of them.
I really, maybe more so than the talking animals, I do get annoyed with these like kids that have impressions or say things that seem so worldly. And it's like, what's going on here? You're like 8 years old and you still carry a metal lunch pail. I mean, it just doesn't make sense to me that some of these kids could have this knowledge and experience that they are supposed to have. So yeah, I hate that one too. What other good ones do we have? Oh, this was an interesting one by a reader named Bart Hansen, who hates characters that pinch the bridge of their nose. That was a very specific one.
Yeah. And in fact, when I was reading that, I was pinching the bridge of my nose, trying to work out if I ever do it and if I had ever noticed anyone in the world doing it. And I guess if you start noticing it in a book, it would start making you so frustrated that maybe you'd want to pinch the bridge of your nose.
Here's one that's been an irritant for so many women for so long, the sexist tropes, which unfortunately we continue to see way too often.
Yeah. There's nothing else to say about it. I mean, yes, you're right.
Women needing rescued, and one reader mentioned sexy descriptions of women doing mundane activities. And I think the example she used was like, you know, a person in a science lab, but she's like incredibly beautiful and alluring and sexy while she's doing her, I don't know, looking into her microscope or her petri dish or whatever. That's annoying. All right. And maybe one last one. This is by a reader named Tobin Anderson, who dislikes depictions of vomiting in books. And he calls vomiting the new crying. And it's some type of hypervaluation of trauma. I haven't noticed a trend in vomiting in the books I've been reading lately. Have you?
I don't think I have, except when I read that, there was something that did ring true for me. This kind of, you can't just be a little bit tearful. Now you've just got to have some horrible spasming physical kind of reaction. And I think it's not just true in books. It's true in, you know, other media, TV, films, everything else, that there is this grief and pain. They've got to be really physically marked on the body almost for them to count. And so I did recognize something there, but I found it very hard to think of specific examples.
Well, yes. But I do agree with what you're saying. There seems to be a tendency that, you know, it's either zero or one. You're either like, okay, or like you're totally falling apart. There's no kind of
everywhere.
Like, there's no moderation in your emotional responses to things. Well, that was all good fun. And thanks to Ron Charles for writing such an entertaining article, and for all of those readers who shared their pet peeves and what they're currently disliking in literature.
Yeah. And I hope you enjoy Ron Charles's newsletter if you subscribe.
Yeah. Subscribe to that newsletter, folks. All right. Thanks, Sam.
Thanks, Laurie.
Hello, Across the Pond listeners. Today, we are so happy to have with us author Stephen May, who's here to talk about his most recent novel, Sell Us the Rope. Hello, Stephen.
Hello. Hello. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
We're very happy to have you, and we're so excited to talk to you about this really fascinating book. I'm wondering if you'd like to start out with reading a few passages from the book for us.
Brilliant. Yeah. So perversely enough, I've leapt in at chapter 16. This is a chapter called High Diving Board. And what you've got here is Koba Stalin. That is Stalin and his love interest walking outside the Houses of Parliament in London in 1907. So dusk outside the Houses of Parliament. Koba and Elie Vuokoba beneath a streetlight. Moths feathering around their heads. The city's noises softened by the yellow fog that weaves itself around them. Elie reaches out a hand to touch the cool, damp railings that surround the building. "Can you believe we're here?" she says. "London?" "Yes, but not just that. That we're in London at this moment, this exact time of change and opportunity, that we're in the capital city of the most powerful country on earth at the dawn of the 20th century, the start of a new era. You, a shoemaker's son, and me, a factory girl, and both of us from places no one's ever heard of, speakers of languages unknown outside their own countries. Don't you think that's bizarre? Koba's face is a mask. He works hard to keep from sighing. Every generation feels that their time and place is special. He is somehow disappointed by the banality of her observation. Life itself is remarkable, he says. Astonishing that anyone is anywhere. Well, that's true, I suppose. She turns away from him, holding the railings with both hands now as she gazes up at the Parliament building, the engine room of the British Empire. He looks at her slender shoulders, her straight back, her neck pale beneath the heavy rope of her hair. My wife thinks everything is proof that there's a God. This city, this building, this light, these insects, the fact of us being here now, the mystery of it all, even the system of government we live under, she would say that they are all proof of a divine creator. He can see Cato now in their small kitchen at home, staring at a cabbage, suddenly transfixed by all its veiny intricacies. He can hear her wondering aloud, how could anyone look at something like this and say there is no God? Probably a mistake to mention his wife. Maybe it will change the mood, kill it completely even. But here is Ellie, turning back to face him, smiling. She takes his arm. Let's get away from the light. No need for him to worry. He had forgotten how ruthless young women can be in pursuit of their own desires. The fact that he has a wife in Tiflis is not going to put her off. Perhaps even makes him seem more desirable. It is possible. They have been wandering the streets of London for hours now, striding away from the Brotherhood Church as if they had an important mission. They had left the East City behind for the West, left behind the poor and familiar for the rich and strange. He has enjoyed the attention they attracted from the people around them today. So many of these English drones so thin and exhausted, so many of them disfigured and weak. Koba knows that among these enfeebled citizens, Ellie and he make an exotic couple. The Viking girl with her extraordinary hair who moves with the loose, self-confident stride of a ballet dancer, restrained power in every step. And the young, dark man with the intense eyes and the boxer swagger. Yes, he is wearing old clothes, a torn coat, a stained cap. But he knows he wears them well, that they flatter him more than a fine suit would. His ragged clothing makes him seem dangerous, more devil-may-care than he is. There is a glamour in his kind of ugliness. I'll stop there.
Very nice, thank you. And I thought, since you started on chapter 16, I might go to the very end of the book, and you've got a really interesting author's note there. Yeah. And you quote George Santayana saying, "History is a pack of lies about events that never happened, told by people who weren't there." Which poses the question, of course, what is a historical novel? Which you partly answer in this fascinating author's note, because you say, you quote Laurent Binet as well, saying fiction respects nothing. So I'm wondering where we are with this book and the relation to the very real people who are in it.
Right. So just to start with the basics, Sam, there was a conference in 1907. All the leading communists were there. Trotsky and Gorky, Stalin, Lenin, they were all there. They all gathered in the East End because they weren't allowed to hold their conference where they'd wanted to hold it in the Russian Empire, and had been kicked out of other countries that were nervous of offending the Russians. And Britain at the time was quite welcoming to dissidents at one level, as it was to refugees, actually. And so they were all meeting there. The British press were fascinated by the idea of all these revolutionists rocking up. They were particularly fascinated with the young women revolutionaries. Rosa Luxemburg was there, amongst others. And the fact that they all did judo training in the morning, that was all a documented fact, that Edith Gerard, who taught the delegates jiu-jitsu in the morning, later went on to train the suffragettes in self-defense. So all of that happened. Stalin was definitely there. Stalin kept his head down. There was some talk at the beginning of the conference that the Georgians were going to have to go home. Stalin was 29. He wasn't the big figure in the party that he later became the biggest beast of them all. But he was considered a bit of a grey man. He would put the hours in. He was a good administrator, you know, sufficiently ruthless, but wasn't amongst the, you know, potential leading figures of the party, you know, as a whole. So there's that's the documented truth, if you like. And then I read a book. I might even have it on my shelf here. No, I don't think I have on it. But I read a book written by a Russian who was convinced that Stalin had been a member of the Russian secret police, the Tsarist secret police, and in fact he was an agent provocateur, and that was the signal. That turned it from, you know, from some interesting reading about a historical moment that I had been doing to a potential novel, because I just decided that was true. And I thought, well, let's just decide that he was an agent for the Tsar. And once you've done that, then it sort of took on its own momentum. Here you've got a man who's, you know, who's having to keep his masters in the secret police happy, but is also trying to not be unmasked, but progress within the Communist Party. And then you put that man, very good looking. I didn't realise that hot Stalin was a thing until I started researching it. Because he's a Stalin at 29. He's a dude. He looks like a hipster poet. He looks like he could be hanging out in the bars of Shoreditch and you know, eating avocados for a brunch on a Saturday morning. So I put that man with his acknowledged energy and magnetism, and put him in collision with some of these fierce and vivacious female party comrades, and let that play itself out as well. So a long-winded answer, Sam, as you'll be aware that I do. But so, you know, there's a bedrock of fact, bedrock of things that you could say this happened and that definitely happened, blended with some things that might have happened, some things that probably happened, quite a lot of things that almost certainly didn't happen, you know. But I really believe in that Binet quote that, you know, that and that book HHHH or ha 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 is along with Hilary Mantel, they're probably the two very different, but the two sort of guiding lights when it came to me tiptoeing into historical fiction, I suppose. You could do what you like, really, and people choose to believe it or not. And it does seem to be a sort of instinctive line that you walk. You know, you don't want the reader to go, oh, well, that would never happen. But equally, you don't want just to tell them what did happen. Otherwise, you'd be a different kind of writer doing a different kind of thing.
So one of the things you can do in historical fiction is put yourself inside the head of the characters. And you put us readers inside Joseph Stalin, you know, one of the most terrible murderers of the 20th century. And I'm wondering about the weight of doing that and taking that leap. I mean, how you approached it initially, I guess, and how it felt as you were going along.
Well, it's funny because, I mean, obviously, you know, Stalin was a monster, but he didn't start off a monster, and had some very good excuses for being a monster. And I think I was probably informed, Sam, by the fact that I've worked in bureaucracies quite a lot. And the Communist Party of Russia is now and was then, you know, a bureaucracy. And it was quite easy to see how someone wanting to progress in that, you know, all murderers, I think, do the minimum that they think they can get away with. And obviously, if they try and protect themselves, and, you know, the minimum gets bigger and bigger, if you like. And certainly, I think, you know, where Stalin was at the beginning was a sort of low-level, ambitious low-level functionary, really, who wants to get on in the party and who's, you know, and that requires him being, you know, prepared to do things that other people won't do. But he's wouldn't see himself as a murderer. He's slightly contemptuous of the bourgeoisie that are around him. He's the only genuine proletarian person that gets near the leadership of the Communist Party. All the others speak many languages. They have had a proper education. And though Stalin was well educated by the standards of most of the people from Georgia at that time, he still didn't have the benefits of private tutors and travel and education that the others have had. So he's an ambitious working class person in the midst of a bureaucracy and trying to make his way in that. So I didn't have to put myself in the head of a mass murderer. I put myself in the head of a hardworking, under pressure clerk, essentially.
Right.
With a propensity to mass murder. That was untapped. Yeah.
Stephen, one of the things that I thought was so fascinating about this book is you depict this group of East Europeans coming across the North Sea and landing on the British coast. And you really were able to kind of let us see the world through their eyes. They hadn't been to London before. And the way that they see what's around them, the poverty and the dirt and the smells and, you know, and some of the reactions that they have to the appearance of the Londoners, especially in the poorer parts of the city. I just wondered whether that was difficult for you to depict. It almost had a Dickensian ring to it to me in several spots in terms of just depicting some of the factory workers and other things that were, I guess, naturally of interest to socialists.
Yeah, I think it was interesting. There were two things. One is that I was quite influenced by the people like Jack London, other people who were writing about the time who'd come from, you know, other places and who were shocked by the poverty they saw around them, and also shocked by the idea that the British people themselves often didn't consider that they were living in poverty, that they thought they were the cradle of civilization. Writing in the shadow of Brexit, that sense of, you know, we're the best, we're the greatest, look how great our society is. Well, actually, it being nothing to be that proud about. You know, so there was a lot of material from people coming from, I mean, Jack London particularly came from, you know, the plains and this, you know, abundance, this sort of abundance of food and clean air and then comes to London. He is shocked and other writers are shocked and the Russians themselves are shocked by the conditions that the British working class are living in. And then the fact that British working class is often saying, yeah, we're so great, we're better than everybody else, because they don't know about anywhere else. And it's that line, Kipling's line, isn't it? You know, what do they know of England that only England know? So it was those two things. Yes, there was the poverty, but there was also the poverty of the British imagination, I think, that I was interested in. And well, I'm glad you think the descriptions come alive. And it was, you know, and it was fun to write it, but it was, and I spent some time wandering around the East End. Much of it's recognizable still from 150 years ago, definitely.
Another thing that really rang true to me was the dialogue between the characters. And I wonder, did you have to endure like reading a lot of socialist communist speeches from back then, or it all just seems, particularly the dialogue between Stalin and, I guess for purposes of this book you might say, his love interest Ellie, yeah. But also the conversations between Rosa Luxemburg and Ellie, and in particular regarding Rosa, one question that I really am curious about is whether Rosa Luxemburg was really as bawdy as you portray her.
Well, I don't know. My reading is she could certainly shock her male comrades and took some delight in doing that, and was definitely frank and forthright in discussing sex. But yeah, I mean, reading the biographies that are written by socialists about their fellow socialists are very, very boring, Laurie. I mean, honestly,
I can imagine.
They're not interested in anything that we might be interested in. It's like, I mean, I tried to read some biographies of some of the leading figures that were around at the time, and they're, you know, they don't tell you what they look like. They tell you, you know, they tell you when they make a speech, but then they focus on all the driest things, the motions that were passed, it's like reading the minutes of Socialist Workers' Party meetings from like 1990. I mean, it is astonishing that they're just, you know, almost determined to kill the personality. You know, for societies that are very keen on the cult of personality, they actually deaden that personality as well. You get no sense of, you know, what they do in their spare time. It's almost like it's embarrassing to have any spare time. So no, I didn't read loads and loads of speeches. you get a flavour of Rosa Luxemburg from her letters. And so I read her letters, which are very passionate, you know, back to her lovers behind and to other figures. And Emma Goldman, too, who isn't part of this story. But if you read what people write in their letters, they're often a lot more interesting than what they say in public. And so Sam will know because Sam's, you know, more than a nodding acquaintance from my other books. So my other books are contemporary set novels. My previous set novels were probably, if you were to boil them down, they're about sort of beta males. They're about sort of men who aren't that successful, who are a bit confused by life and muddle through. So is Stalin. He's one of those people too, at some level. There is a sort of connection. But I'm glad you felt the dialogue was believable. It is, you know, that's where you know characters in their speech, I think.
I want to get to Stalin as a beta male, but before I do, I'm really interested in those socialist biographies. Well, not in reading them, because made them sound pretty dire. But
I've done it so you don't have to, Sam.
Yeah, thank you. I'm grateful. But the thing I am wondering is how interested those biographies are in the women at all. I mean, because, you know, history does not record many of these women, certainly not to the same extent as the men. You know, Rosa Luxemburg is pretty famous, but it's hard to think of other people.
And very exceptional and had to do some exceptional things and at various points. So people... Other higher-ups in the party tried to, you know, they were all trying to slap her down, accusing her of being a spy. You know, it was sort of assumed that there's a real double standard. I mean, an extraordinary double standard when it comes to women leaders in the party. However, I'd also say within the Communist Party that they, of the time, that women had a bit more agency and a bit more autonomy than they had in other political systems. I mean, other political parties. I mean, you know, there were women regiments in the army. They were doing the weapons training. They did have these female delegates there. I mean, Elie Wiecko is largely a product of my imagination. However, she is emblematic of lots of women that did speak at the conference. It's almost like there was a cut-off point beyond which you weren't allowed to go as a woman in the party. But, you know, they were encouraged to be active at lower levels. And trade union delegates, they made a big thing. The male leaders of the party made a big thing about how interested in women's suffrage they were and how interested in women's agency they were. Beyond a certain point, though, it didn't. I mean, Gorky's wife, who appears very briefly in my novel, the actress, you know, was a leading figure in the party. It wasn't his wife, his companion, you know, an important figure as well. So it's not a clear-cut picture, I would say. But, yeah, certainly as the nearer you got to the top, the more barriers were put in your way, I think. And it's interesting, the British press were absolutely fascinated and, you know, agog by the idea that that there were these fiery women delegates there. I think that the male leaders of the Communist Party were very aware of how useful for propaganda purposes the picture of a female revolutionary was.
On that point, I was really intrigued by a set piece that you have in the book, Stephen, where Maxim Gorky's mistress is giving a pep talk for a small group of the high-level socialists, communists, before they go into a big, fancy reception that's being hosted by a very wealthy philanthropist. And they need his money. They want a big donation from him.
Yeah, yeah. Big American philanthropist as well.
Yeah. So she's trying to tell them, you know, just culturally how you kind of butter up these people and what you need to focus on. And then when you actually place the characters at the party, you have them kind of thinking to themselves about all of these tips, this pep talk that they had and kind of responding to it as they were, you know, kind of mingling in the party. And it almost ruled like a movie screen for me. Like I could see it so vividly. I wondered how you got the idea for that.
Right. Okay. So that was really interesting you picked up on that scene, because what I did was read lots of current articles about, you know, how to make your party go with a swing, how to network, from current women's magazines. So I was reading a Cosmopolitan and lots of online articles about how to network and how to be the perfect host. And so a lot of those rules, they're not from any etiquette manual of 1907. They're actually, Maxim's Gorky's mistress recite these rules, but they're very contemporary rules of how to get on and how to don't do too much touching, eye contact, but don't stare because people then get scared and they're trying to remember it. And I just thought it was fun that they'd be trying to remember the rules, but also getting drunk on newly invented American cocktails. So it becomes harder to stick to as you
lots of fun. They really liked the daiquiris that were introduced.
Yes, the daiquiris were a new thing. I mean, in terms of research, this is it's not necessarily the thing you're looking for. It's the thing. So you'll be reading an article, in the press of 1907, and there's the thing you need to read for your story, but then there's the thing next to it, and the thing, the advert, and it's those things. I'm often distracted by those things, which then weave their way back into the book. And that's the fun of it, really. It's the
serendipity almost.
Discover. So the daiquiri came out of the American success in the war against Spain and the invasion of Cuba, and so the daiquiri was to celebrate that. I had no idea. I mean, I love to learn things in books, and I love to learn things writing books. I think
I've got to come back to Stalin as a beta male, because I'm just imagining, for instance, the Stalin as he's portrayed in The Death of Stalin, the film. It's much not a beta male, and something horrible would happen to you in all probability if you made that kind of suggestion. So I'm curious to know, what made you think he was that kind of man, and how that plays out in the book?
Well, I mean, so Stalin's had he's had an extraordinarily brutal upbringing, and he's surrounded by people, and he's had to struggle for everything, and he hasn't got the accomplishments that seem to come really easily to other people. They can speak English, they can speak German, they can speak French. They hang out at the museum when they're in the conference in London. They're in Bloomsbury, he's in Stepney. And he has chips on his shoulder about all of those things, but he's also got he's sort of contemptuous of the soft natures of the others. But he also, he's sort of locked out. He's an outsider. He can't get in. That I think I very much felt as I was writing that he would feel locked out of. That he was never going to fit in. And he learned to speak Russian fluently eventually at the age of nine. He didn't start learning Russian until he was nine. He can speak English, actually, in private. He told people that you should listen to preachers if you wanted to learn English. But he is so uncertain that he never speaks it publicly once he becomes a Russian leader. And so it's that sense that he's going to make mistakes and that he doesn't know how to behave in good company. He's a great singer. He has things to offer in that world. But that he feels locked out. He feels shoved to one side. That it's not for the likes of him. And I think a lot of us feel like that. A lot of us feel like Stalin. So. I don't know if that's a very good answer, but I just decided that someone who's 29, a kind of, trying to make their career, who's got himself, involved in the secret police, he's got a workflow. He's got a set of tasks that have to be fulfilled. He's got people that expect things from him, and he doesn't quite know how to do them all. He's got a life that's a bit out of control. And he's a new dad, and he's a new, so that he's an unlikely figure to rise to the leadership of the Russian Communist Party, I think. And he would definitely feel that.
That's one of the really fascinating things about reading this book, I think, is that you realise that it wasn't inevitable that he would become Joseph Stalin, this guy who crashed through the 20th century in the way he did. And that doubt you sew into the narrative, it's really fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, there are a lot of, I think I say at one point, you know, there are a lot of other figures that you know, the Menshevik figures particularly that could have risen to the top. You know, and Trotsky, of course, you know, Trotsky was much more charismatic figure than I mean, Stalin was actually the least charismatic of the leaders. And who knows what would have happened if Lenin hadn't died so young.
It is interesting, though. I think you do a really good job, and I know that it's fraught with peril to try to psychoanalyze Stalin too much, and so many people have tried to do that, but you show like a real scrappy cleverness on his part. Mm. And I really liked the way that you brought out this ability, like when he's being questioned by Lenin and Trotsky about what he plans to kind of say is a spy within the party, but it's kind of in a way to kind of deflect attention from him because he is the spy. But he's, as he's talking to them, and it seems like they're like, he senses they're trying to like set him up, you know, kind of nab him, so he kind of changes his whole narrative. Yeah. There's like a lot of like just kind of thinking on his feet and kind of like a boxer, you know, just kind of like shuffling.
Yes.
And meeting.
Yes, exactly. I think that's you say scrappy cleverness exactly, and that boxer, you know, that I think is how I imagined him all the time I was writing, that he, you know, that he's an astute reader of body language actually, and a sort of cynical psychologist, if you like. And it's interesting because this time is also the birth of, you know, it's the birth of the great isms of anarchism and communism. They were all, you know, codifying themselves, but also psychoanalysis was also, you know, hitting its stride at the time. So, he's a, as you have to be, really, I think, if you're going to be a spy, you're a very sharp reader of body language and where things feel off. Yes. And so I think, if you're under the dual pressure of a very paranoid party system, and also working with the secret police, and that you're this kind of double agent, agent provocateur, that you've got to be on your toes the whole time. He couldn't be lax at all. And you think that actually he was underestimated by, in real life, I think, he was underestimated by, you know, everyone around him. So, you know, they never saw him as a threat until he was already, until it was too late, definitely. And, of course, there are parallels with Putin there as well. I mean, you know, they were inescapable while I was writing the book. I didn't think he was going to invade Ukraine. I had no inkling in 2021 that he was going to do that. But the parallels of a grey man rising to the top of the Communist Party are really clear, I think. Though Putin is no Stalin, I think he's not as smart as Stalin was.
There's kind of a theme in the book that Stalin constantly feels haunted. Like there's he sees, yeah, things, he sees shadows, he sees images of people that he's killed. And at the end of the book, when Ellie and he are imagining their futures, he imagines his future as being fraught with, quote, growing numbers of the dead crowding in on him, killing his rest, staring at him in parks like this, and numbers he can't ignore. I don't know. What's your sense? Do you feel like Stalin, the man, just kind of resigned himself to the fact that he was going to do whatever he had to do to reach power and hold on to power, and that these ghosts that haunted him were just a price he had to pay? And I guess as a corollary to that, how much of his belief system do you think was truly like believing in that socialism was going to embetter humanity, or was it just a power grab for him?
I think this is sort of more or less complete guess, but I think he did think that things would be better for most people under in a communist state. But as he progressed, it became less important because he had to protect himself personally. I think Stalin saw himself as keeping himself alive as long as he could. I mean, there's a bit in the book where he dreams of becoming a sort of civil servant in somewhere in the secret police, you know, laugh at him for having that dream, because he's in the system now and it's just about keeping alive as long as you can. And I think Stalin never expected to, you know, he acknowledged he'd have to do worse and worse things to stay ahead of, you know, it's a gangland. It's like The Sopranos. It's a gangland culture that he's in. Eventually he gets capped. And I think that's what he's thinking, and that he will kill more and more people, you know, a bit like, I didn't think this at the time, but a bit like Tony Soprano. He thinks you can keep ahead of the people who want your job for a little while. And then you inevitably, you know, stumble and fall and get whacked. And so I think he doesn't imagine becoming leader of Russia. He imagines, you know, just staying ahead of the executioners from one side or another as long as he possibly can. And I suppose, yeah, I mean, all the people he's killed up to that point have been, you know, he's seen them as necessary victims, and they've been individual victims. When he's sitting in the park at the age of 29 in 1907 with Ellie, I don't think he's thinking that there will be, you know, that he'll be responsible for famine or the gulags or anything like that. But he is thinking that there will be people, you know, and in fact, I think it's Stalin himself says, you know, the death of one person is a tragedy, or the death of a million people is a statistic. So it's the individual deaths that will haunt him. It's interesting. I mean, I just think, I mean, in the end, he died in his bed of a stroke. He died an old man's death, the one we might all hope for, actually.
Well, Stephen, it was so nice to have you with us today. It's just such a thrilling and interesting book. Really enjoyed it. And thank you for discussing it with us today. It's been our great pleasure.
Thank you very much. I'm so pleased that it's got out there, because honestly, Sam, you'll remember. So I had a bit of a flurry of success with a book about 10 years ago, and then my share price fell. And so it was nice to write a different kind of book, and then to find it's resonated,
Come back strong. It's great.
Yeah, it's been great. And thanks. It's really, you've really made me think about the book as well. I mean, it's sometimes hard to remember what you were doing or what you were thinking or what you were hoping, because you just, you know, in the act of creating it, I think you are working quite a lot at the sort of unconscious level, you know. I'd really believe that. You sort of, well, at least you're in trying to be in tandem. The unconscious is the surfboard that you are riding, and your capacity to steer it is there, but limited, I would say.
Well, I want to encourage all of our listeners to run out to their local independent bookstore and purchase a copy of Sell Us the Rope by Stephen May. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for that. Lovely to talk to you.